listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm in London. It's miserable, but not nearly as miserable as it is in the place we're going to be talking about.
That's a fair assessment. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project. I've known you for around 20 years. All of that time, you've been engaged in the Israel-Palestine issue. And in fact, before that, you're involved in negotiations, I think, at both Camp David and Taba on the Israeli side. No, you're a citizen of both Israel and Britain, is that right? And for all I know, America?
Yeah, that's right. And I was involved actually during my IDF service in Israel in the talks under Prime Minister Rabin in Oslo B. And then I was kind of back room in Israel for Camp David, but in the negotiating room itself for Taba.
Oh, so the trifecta. Those are actually the three, a lot of people say the three most hopeful moments of the past several decades: Oslo, Camp David, and Taba, right?
Well, Camp David is a strange one, which we may or may not go into, but build-up, yes, it was like, okay, we're going for it. The meeting itself was a bit of a disaster.
Let me do some. I want to start by talking about more current events, but let me do some crass self promotion, and we'll get back to Camp David by the end of the conversation. The crass self promotion is: I wrote a piece in 2002 called "Was Arafat the Problem?" Meaning, in Slate, you can Google it. That's the title, arguing that the so-called state offered Palestine wasn't quite as generous an offer as some had said. You're nodding your head. And this was after Robert Malley wrote his piece for the New York Review of Books, I think.
Exactly.
But maybe we'll get to that. So a couple of things just this morning, I got up and saw that the U.S. National Intelligence Director has issued her annual report. And there were a couple of things. One was that the war in Gaza seems to be arousing and energizing terrorist enemies of the U.S. and Israel around the world. The other was that the Gaza war poses a threat to the Netanyahu government. Of course, it was also an opportunity for the Netanyahu government. But I'm curious, the second issue about the current political situation I'm interested in, both because of that assessment and because last week, I think it was, Benny Gantz, political rival of Netanyahu's, came, visited the U.S. He's a member of the war cabinet, along with Bibi, but a political rival. Apparently, Netanyahu wasn't happy about that, found it threatening. Perhaps that's the way the U.S. administration intended it. I've wondered, there are kind of two questions about how much power the Biden administration has. One is how much leverage they have to actually bring hostilities to an end. I hope to get to that. But there's also the question of, like, do they have the power to do regime change, in effect, to unseat Netanyahu with maneuvers like this, I guess, by empowering political rivals or whatever Netanyahu feared was going on here?
I would say to that that I can sketch out a scenario that I think is really quite plausible, that the Biden administration, any U.S. administration, has the ability to bring what is going on in Gaza to a halt, to actually get to a ceasefire. And I believe that is much the most important thing to be trying to do. I think one could also make a case that they could do regime change in Israel. It might be the case that you need to do the latter in order to achieve the former, although I could paint a scenario whereby you wouldn't need to do that. I think the latter is more difficult to get the regime change. To get the regime change in Israel. I would also say this, the Yeah. The really burning thing is to bring an end to what's going on in Gaza. If that requires regime change, then I think that would be as a consequence, as a byproduct of taking the approach that one needs to bring an end to what's going on in Gaza. I do think that the idea that a Gantz-led administration suddenly opens a vista to all kinds of tremendous peacemaking opportunities is for the birds. It's a pipe dream. That's yeah. not the case.
I mean, he's not that far left to begin with, leaving aside, I gather, on the spectrum of Israeli political actors. But that aside, the public, how much support there would be in the public for any kind of ambitious long-term solution to the problem seems very in doubt. I mean, more in doubt as a result of October 7th, right?
Yes, but let's not underestimate how little support there was for that prior to October 7th either. Mm-hmm. I think Israel has gone on this incremental journey in its political life to a place where almost the entirety of the parliamentary Jewish Zionist political spectrum is, I think the most honest word to describe it would be on the apartheid spectrum. Now, there's an extreme wing of that for whom apartheid is, perhaps there's a degree of honesty to this position, that apartheid is not sustainable and what you really need to do is ethnic cleansing. So that's the Ben Gvir Smotrich, and they've been quite open about that, eradication, permanent displacement, a second Nakba, referring to the physical removal of Palestinians from the territorial expanse.
And these are the two kind of most extreme members of the cabinet whose names you just mentioned.
Exactly. So there's a degree of familiarity now with these names. The national security / police minister, Itamar Ben Gvir, from the Jewish Power Party, and the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, and they came together. They ran together and then re-separated into their constituent parts, Smotrich being the religious Zionist party. Just in case anyone is unfamiliar with that detail about these extremists, where did they come together? Where did they form that party in advance of the last election? In Benjamin Netanyahu's home in Caesarea. Netanyahu was worried Israel's electoral system is a pure proportional representation system, but you need to hit a certain threshold in order to enter parliament. If you're below that threshold, all your votes go to waste. Netanyahu was concerned that some of those far-right votes would go to waste rather than be part of the building blocks for a coalition that he would need. He brings the two to his home in Caesarea. That's where the final deal is sealed. And it's just one of the many either intentional misreadings or just inabilities to get to grips with the granularity of Israeli politics that the Biden administration has displayed. And so this is where I'd also urge caution in terms of them thinking they can do regime change and them thinking it's terribly smart to invite Mr. Gantz. They have so misplayed this in terms of how their policies have impacted domestic Israeli politics that I really wouldn't want to leave anything like that in their hands. And it's almost to me.
Can you elaborate on that? What have they done wrong?
So let's take ourselves back to before October 7th. Okay.
Okay.
Because what you had when Netanyahu forms this government and brings in these people who, I mean, this is the degree of extremism of and the public statements of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, I think is a hard thing for people to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, can I just try out my favorite antidote? Because it blows my mind. One of them, until a couple of years ago, and when he was going to get into politics and had to clean up his act a little, had a portrait of Baruch Goldstein in his house. Baruch Goldstein walked into a mosque with a submachine gun. He was a settler extremist in Hebron and gunned down. However, he killed dozens of Palestinians. This guy had just walked in You know, there was no provocation. He just wanted to slaughter Palestinians in the West Bank. And this guy had a portrait of him on his wall. I think that was some time in painting, you know. I mean,
yeah, you know, you've done the work for me there. Exactly. And a little kind of coda to that story of Baruch Goldstein, Hebron massacre is it is after that that we see the Palestinian deployment of suicide bombings for the first time.
So this is right before the Second Intifada that he did this?
No, this is early on in Oslo. This is significantly before the Second Intifada. Okay. It's much earlier on, Baruch Goldstein. Okay. So this is Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Now, as is their typical modus operandi, the administration sends these kind of, we don't like these guys. They don't meet with them. But this is part of the coalition. You don't actually treat the governing coalition any differently. The administration has already not reversed in any significant way anything the Trump administration before it did. But not only that, a government of this extremism is fated with yet more American goodies. So I just want people to wrap their heads around this. The government of Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich is the Israeli government which the Biden administration chooses to bestow the visa waiver program, that Israelis no longer need a visa to enter the United States, something every Israeli government had clamored for, had desperately wanted to achieve. Who did they give this to? Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, and Bibi.
This is before October 7th?
This is before October 7th. Mm-hmm. This is
So they should have dished out some negative reinforcement to the coalition as a whole, the government, rather than, you know, what they would say in their defense is, well, you know, since October 7th, we've sanctioned several settlers, you know, and they also, I think, said, no, we won't send rifles because we think they'll be redirected towards settlers at some point. I applaud that. Great. But you're saying it should have started earlier, and the entire ruling coalition should have been held accountable for having these two guys in it, basically.
Yeah, so let me unpack two things in there. Look, first of all, when the Biden administration comes in, Bibi is not yet in power. They're still working with the previous short-lived government led by Naftali Bennett, with Gantz, in the government then with Yair Lapid. That government conspicuously does nothing to advance anything positive. Settlements continue. In fact, it's under that government that intensive military raids into the hearts of the Palestinian West Bank cities resume. Extrajudicial assassinations are resumed by that government. They declare six leading Palestinian NGOs, including the main human rights organization on the Palestinian side, which documents not only Israeli abuses, but also Palestinian Authority abuses, an organization by the name of Al-Haq. Israel designates those as criminal terrorist entities, and the Americans fail to push back on that. So things aren't looking splendid. And then this very extreme government comes in, and there's a bit of kind of verbal acrobatics around not meeting Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, but it's business as usual. So the two main planks of the policy, I would suggest, with Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, Netanyahu, are pursuing normalization. So if, again, and it's still on, it's, you know, we're still treated to a regular... By Tom Friedman.
Israel and Arab state Saudi Arabia in particular, and we should say that this is a continuation of the Trump Abraham Accords kind of momentum. In retrospect, a lot of people think that this may have been maybe the major cause of October 7th, certainly an attempt to derail what was very threatening to the Palestinians, threatening to Hamas, the idea of normalizing relations with all these Arab states without addressing the Israel-Palestine conflict. Presumably, the planning would have started, I don't know, during the Trump part of it for October 7th. I mean, but Biden chose to continue that without seriously bringing the Palestinian issue into it as a prerequisite, solving that as a prerequisite. And then so there we are. If there's anything about that you want to correct or you disagree with, go ahead. But no, I just want to provide that context for people.
I would just double down, actually, on what you pointed out, that the Biden administration absolutely continues. It gives some kind of rhetorical gestures that, hey, there are Palestinians, but it absolutely continues with the Trump policy of trying to do an end run around the Palestinians with this normalization. They established something called Negev Forum with the normalized countries. That's under the previous Israeli government. And then the centerpiece, almost the obsession in Middle East policy of the administration becomes this Saudi normalization. Now, I think they're doing it for U.S. geopolitical reasons. Maybe we will or will not come back to that. We won't go into it now. And you have this constant back and forth of visits of Jake Sullivan and Brett McGurk, senior national security officials in the administration to Saudi, looking to expand this relationship. Now, by doing that, I think they were sending the signal that Israel can carry on, even with this kind of a government, making things worse with the Palestinians, and will carry on pursuing this regional integration. And of course, people are familiar with the speeches, but also with the famous print version of the Jake Sullivan Foreign Affairs article, where he's telling us that this is the most peaceful Middle East in generations. And they're giving speeches in the weeks leading up to October 7th saying, look out for you know, how we're integrating the region. And the big thing, just prior to October 7th, it feels like a different universe. But in September, there is the G20 meeting under the then presidency of India, which takes place in Delhi. And on the sidelines of the G20, there is an announcement made of the India-Middle East-Europe corridor, which is this idea that you're going to link India, Saudi and the Gulf states, and Israel. And that announcement is made by the Americans. It's chaperoned by the Americans. This is something that Sullivan and Blinken speak to a lot in those speeches at that time. They say, look out for IMEC. This is the abbreviation. Look out for I2U2, India, Israel, UAE, USA. This is the story of the future. Netanyahu, at the end of September in the annual UN General Assembly meetings, he stands up. He loves his graphic displays. It's a bit of a genre of Netanyahu when he's speaking at the UN. And he pulls out this map of the new Middle East and those who are moving forward and those who will be left behind. Of course, Palestine is colored as part of Israel, the Palestinian occupied territories. So that's where we are in terms of the failure of the policy leading into October 7th. They have gone along the line that the Palestinian issue can just be managed at very low cost. They missed an opportunity, and this is something else that I would just point out. They missed an opportunity earlier on. Palestinian elections, there haven't been elections for the Palestinian representative institutions for a decade and a half. Now it's almost more, but at the time... Mm-hmm. They are scheduled to begin in April 2021. Mahmoud Abbas, hated by his own public, no credibility. People will note that he has barely appeared during the most calamitous period for his people. He's indefinitely postpones, in effect, cancels those elections. And in the lead up, the US had been encouraging the cancellation, postponement of those elections, partly because they were scared that Hamas wouldn't necessarily win, but would be part of a governing formation. If that had happened, I would at least postulate as a counterfactual. So I can't prove this, but we would not be where we are today because Hamas was looking for a way to be integrated, as it has done for many years, into the Palestinian body politic and hand over much of the governance of Gaza, which it is not particularly interested in, to a different Palestinian body.
Yeah. Can I?
One other thing I'd say on this, Bob, let me do one other thing on this, which is those who claim that the Abraham Accords, the normalization, would be a game changer. We've now been able to test this in real time, whether it has impacted stability in the Middle East and how it has impacted the Palestinian-Israeli question over the last more than 5 months. And we have seen that it has contributed nothing to regional stability and has been at best a sideshow and perhaps an encourager of Israeli extremism.
Yeah, on this issue of an opportunity to bring Hamas into a Hamas kind of Palestinian authority, I guess, coalition or whatever you want to call it, that's not technically what it is, that apparently you're saying was maybe missed shortly before October 7th. There's a little deja vu here. Again, we won't revisit it, but one more instance of self-promotion. I wrote a piece called The Truth About Hamas, revisiting what happened right after the last Hamas elections and the misconceptions about it and what really happened, which was virtually, I think, criminal in terms of what the U.S. in particular did after that, but also what Israel did in trying to keep at all costs, you know, Palestinian governance in essence divided. So that they wouldn't have to talk seriously about two state or anything else. So there were mistakes made before October 7th. I think even Biden would say, maybe he shouldn't have embraced Netanyahu so tightly right after October 7th. But to bring it up to right now, If you could just magically control the Biden administration, and I assume you would like to do these two outcomes that you say are kind of closely related, bringing hostilities to a halt and unseating the Netanyahu coalition. If you were to try to do either, or I guess in a certain sense, ideally both of those. What would you start doing right now that's just different from what Biden is doing, or what is he doing right? For all I know,
no, that's a really short conversation.
We can skip that part. Okay.
Yep. I don't want to be glib. I genuinely think, and I don't know why. I can make some guesses, but I genuinely think this has been handled in a horrible way, in a deeply counterproductive way, unless they have an interest in going from plausible genocide to an actual finding of genocide in terms of what is happening to the Palestinians. I do not know whether it is a consequence that when you know that the policy framework in which you're operating is so constrained because you're not willing to challenge Israel in meaningful ways, that you therefore start doing things which are extremely unlikely to produce serious outcomes. But you kind of tell yourself, well, this is the best chance we've got. So what could they do? It's a crucial question. And I don't want to make my life easy by suggesting that, look, one phone call, Biden clicks his finger, and this is done. I don't think that's the case, actually. What I think they could do is the following, and I want to acknowledge up front that my assessment is that it would probably require a sustained standoff with the Israeli leadership. Mm-hmm. If you go down this path, you have to be willing to be in an uncomfortable interaction with Netanyahu and others in that leadership over a period of time. I don't think it would take that long, at least until one got a stop to this. And the key thing, I would say, is you make the policy fight about hostage release and ceasefire, getting that deal done. Let me stay on this for a moment.
And get into the details a little, because there's a perception in American media, and I have no idea who's right, but that Hamas is the problem. I mean, it seems to be certainly the case that there's not a meeting of minds here, and Hamas is demanding more than they're being given. But, you know, the presentation by the administration is, okay, there's a deal on the table, and now we just have to see if Hamas accepts it. It's kind of like negotiations generally, where the U.S. says, okay, this Israeli deal on the table, it's the Palestinians' fault if it's not accepted. But I don't know the details here. And is it your sense that some of the media presentation suggests that this guy Sinwar, the leader in Gaza of Hamas, has just calculated that there's enough opposition to the Netanyahu policy building that all he has to do is wait and will not do any kind of hostage deal at all. And ultimately, this will be catastrophic for Israel if Netanyahu persists. So kind of like bring it on if you want to try. And the perception is he's willing to abide any amount of carnage. And clearly, I think he is willing to abide a lot of Palestinian deaths, although I'm not sure he anticipated this many when he launched this operation on October 7th. Anyway, can you really start like kind of right there? In other words, you do think there is a deal that is doable by your reading of the signals from both sides and everything? You could get a hostage deal that ended hostilities?
So let me get into that. The points about Sinwar, I would just caveat by saying, I don't think one can overpersonalize it around him. There is a decision-making structure of which I would suggest it would be a mistake to overestimate his primus inter pares role.
Including the guys not in Gaza. So you think they have real... The political leadership.
You have the external exiled political leadership. You have the leadership in Gaza. You have the Politburo, the Shura Council of Hamas. I think he, Sinwar and others would say this is, and yeah, I don't want to suggest that they are, you know, doing what's best for everyone in Gaza. I think that is not a credible claim. I think they would say that this is what a people has to go through. Look at the losses the Algerians sustained to achieve their freedom. Look at the losses the Vietnamese sustained to achieve their freedom, etc. I think we have to just simply acknowledge that they have far more credibility for having taken on Israel than other Palestinian actors, and certainly than the American-backed folks who are seen as complicit and working hand-in-hand with the Israelis in Ramallah, in the West Bank. And it would be a mistake to suggest that negotiations with Hamas are easy, and I'm not about to suggest that. And one can't skip over what happened on October 7th. One has to hold at the same moment the three things: that the reality that existed before October 7th, of permanent Palestinian dispossession, structural violence against the Palestinians, a regime credibly meeting the legal definition of apartheid. That really matters. You can't understand things without that. October 7th, violations of international law are committed since October 7th. And right in the day one, the Israelis come out with the collective punishment of Palestinian civilians, no food, fuel, water, electricity, and the crimes committed by Israel since October 7th. One has to keep those all in mind. But when it comes to this negotiation, Hamas is not going to agree to step down, release the hostages at any price, despite what is happening in Gaza. Anyone who suggests that they will do so has apparently never read any history, not only in the Israeli-Palestinian, Israeli-Hamas talks, but of any kind of resistance to a belligerent occupation.
Yeah, it seems to me, to put a finer point, I mean, I've always thought there's kind of no way, unless their backs are against the wall in a way they're not, like they face the prospect of all the entire military leadership dying or something, and including Sinwar. Barring that, I've always thought they're just not going to give up all the hostages until there's what they see as an enduring settlement. It's not like, for 6 weeks of peace, we'll give you all of our bargaining chips and then have at us. Of course not. And there seems to be in some corners almost an expectation of that. Now, I don't mean anyone high up in the administration is that naive, but anyway, I assume this is part of the issue.
Yes, and the backdrop to what you're saying is that there is not sufficient attrition on the battlefield in the balance of forces for either party to say, okay, look, Hamas has taken a hit, but they have shown resilience. Israel has not done spectacularly on the battlefield. It has caused a lot of self-harm, and Hamas is banking on that. When you know that the other party is much more powerful, has much more to lose, that's asymmetrical warfare. And Israel has fallen straight into that trap. The level of destruction, the statements that have come out of the Israelis, the actions that they have taken, Israel has lost this war. I think one just has to acknowledge that. Now, given that the balance of forces, narrowly speaking, on the battlefield is not going to lead to a capitulation by either side, one goes to the mediation. The talks that have been ongoing successfully, those talks in late November secured the release of 100 plus Israeli hostages. There were 8 days of quiet. There were some Palestinian prisoners released from Israeli jails. But then, as Netanyahu committed to doing, the Israeli military action resumed. That deal, by the way, has been on the table. The deal of, and this, Hamas aren't holding these hostages for no reason. They're not justified, but they are holding them as in order, and some of them are soldiers, in order to get Palestinians released from Israeli jails, which has happened in the past. And the deal has been available really since week four.
You mean a deal that would have done what has been available?
It would have ended permanent ceasefire. Hostages out, the terms for reorganizing, kind of reorganizing Israel's withdrawal from Gaza, the conditions in the Gaza, and the release of Palestinian prisoners. Now, that looks different today because the degree of devastation, the humanitarian needs as a result of Israel's largely indiscriminate actions in urban terrain look different today to how they look then. Now,
so this is a deal that would have, well, left Hamas intact. They could have declared victory, I guess, in principle, which is one thing Israel wouldn't like. But when you say it was available, I mean, what are the terms? What would have involved?
Right. So the terms have shifted. Now, Hamas is not intact. Netanyahu says October 7th should never be repeated. Of the three things, and of course, one wouldn't want to see October 7th repeated, but of the three things that will guarantee October 7th is never repeated, I would argue the military operation against Hamas is the least significant. So I think the first thing to secure the non-repetition of October 7th is that you no longer are keeping Palestinians in those conditions without their rights, without their freedoms, living under an apartheid regime. The second thing is you never have an Israeli military that is so focused on defending and advancing the cause of the settlers in the West Bank that is so full of hubris and arrogance that it is ill-prepared in terms of its military intelligence, in terms of its deterrence, in terms of its immediate military reaction. The third thing is, what is the capacity of Hamas? The capacity of Hamas has been impacted. Now, since the effort to put together a second package after the collapse of the first pause, that was upgraded. As people will be familiar, you saw Bill Burns, the head of the CIA, getting engaged. You had this format where the Prime Minister of Qatar and his negotiating team, the head of Egyptian intelligence, Burns, the head of the CIA, and the head of the Israeli Mossad, another is senior Israeli security personnel, have been meeting. Now, a paper comes out of that that was then tweaked and worked with and refined in a meeting in Paris last month. That paper goes into a degree of detail. And what it does is it sets out three phases in which the non-male combatants who are being held in Gaza would be the first phase of the release, and I'll come back to that. Second phase is the male combatants. Third phase is the bodies of Israelis who, whether in the attack on October 7th, whether at the hands of Israeli airstrikes, are no longer alive.
Mm-hmm.
In each of those phases, there will be releases of Palestinian prisoners. At the end of that, there's a permanent ceasefire. What they have subsequently done is gone into significant detail. I've seen the bridging proposal. It's not a bridging proposal, though. It's America working with Israel on the proposal, unfortunately, which is something we're used to in other contexts. So there's significant detail there, Bob, on exactly where would Israeli military forces be deployed? What would be the key, the ratio of Palestinian prisoners released in exchange for the Israelis in the first phase? Mm-hmm. What, under what terms could humanitarian assistance get in? The extent of that humanitarian assistance? Under what terms could Palestinians return to the north of Gaza during this pause? Uh-huh. Where we are is that Hamas has responded to what is essentially an Israeli-American proposal. Israel has not then responded to that response. Now, there's an...
So Hamas has put a deal on the table that they would accept?
I don't want to say that Hamas has said these are the exact terms, but they have given their responses. Now, the understanding on the part of all of those involved, including people who have spoken to members of the Israeli war cabinet, is that there is a zone for an agreement. The main, there's a major fault line, and then there are details. The major fault line is the Israeli side is saying this can only be a pause. It cannot be a permanent ceasefire. Netanyahu, as we have heard frequently, mm-hmm. his commitment mm-hmm. is war will continue. We mm-hmm. will attack Rafah. Now, by yeah. saying that, he's undermining the talks from the get-go. The Hamas position right. is this must be the on-ramp to a guaranteed permanent ceasefire. However, what we have at the moment is there is a willingness on the Hamas side for there to be ambiguity in that question of how locked in is the permanent ceasefire and the full Israeli withdrawal. So there is an opportunity to have a deal where the things that now get thrashed out are those details I mentioned. How much humanitarian aid gets in? What are the guarantees for it getting in? What are the terms for Palestinians to return to the north of Gaza? What is the ratio of prisoners mm-hmm. who are being held by Israel in exchange for the Israelis being held in Gaza? And the U.S., and this is the crucial, one of the two crucial things to wrap one's head around. The U.S. has a choice, and I recognize it's not an easy choice. Either you can play your usual game and say, the Israelis have put forward a reasonable position. The Palestinians have rejected it. Now, I recognize it's even harder to do that where the Palestinian side is Hamas. And America seems just unwilling to go to that place mm-hmm. where it acknowledges that there's a reasonable position. I say this with caution, but the facts seem to back this up, that there is a more reasonable position being put forward by Hamas than being put forward by Prime Minister Netanyahu. You wouldn't have to say it like that, by the way. I think what the administration could do would be to put forward a genuine bridging proposal.
Yeah.
In terms of what are the parameters for a deal. Now, Netanyahu has said Hamas is not interested.
So kind of go public. Because let me say by analogy, I've always thought that the way to actually do a two-state solution back when it seemed possible, leaving aside the question of whether it is now or ever will be, was for the U.S., rather than go to Israel and put something on the table and say more or less take it or leave it with very minor adjustment, do the opposite. Find something that would work for the Palestinians. And of course, this assumes no domestic political strengths in America, but indulge the thought experiment and say, we think this is reasonable. Here are the specifics. And we just can't continue to support Israel in the way we have if they don't think it's reasonable. I mean, that's so far from being conceivable and by conventional American political reckoning. But anyway, you're kind of talking about something similar. In other words, get a sense for what would work from the Palestinian side and to some extent actually lay it out there and embrace it.
The reason I would argue that if they want to see an end to this, and I can't say, given how they've behaved, with confidence that the administration does want to see an end to this, but let's go with that thought experiment as well. If they wanted to see an end to this, I think that would be the way to go, to put something forward. Now, Netanyahu has said, and America seems ready to play that blame game rather than get a deal done, that Hamas is uninterested. In the Israeli papers, an Israeli correspondent, Ben Kaspit, has quoted a war cabinet minister as saying Netanyahu's depiction of the talks, and I'm quoting here, is a series of lies. Now, America has a choice. The Biden administration has a choice. Does it want to back up Bibi's blame game series of lies, or does it want to put forward a position? And even when Kamala Harris, the Veep, made that speech in Selma, which was like, oh, look, they're shifting tone, she continued to be in the blame game business. And in the, she said, immediate ceasefire, 4-6 weeks. Now, why do I say this is the crucial terrain on which to work? Because I think if the administration did that, then you unleash a very hard to manage internal dynamic in Israel. Mm-hmm. In the military, many of whom think they need to get this deal done, many of whom, by the way, acknowledge that there's an exhaustion on the part of the Israeli forces. They sent home some of the reservists. They have not called them up again. They cannot do Rafah, not because of anything America is saying, but because they are not militarily in a position to deploy. It doesn't mean they won't be in a few weeks. They will be if this is allowed to continue. But you will have the military divided and, I think, erring more on the side of supporting the deal. You will have the war cabinet divided. You will have the public divided. You will see, I think, an escalation in what already has been a shift in the willingness to protest that we have seen in the last 3 weeks inside Israel. So I think you, rather than doing the things that the administration has done, which is name-calling and expressing mm-hmm. disappointment and frustration and talking about the day after, by the way, the administration has said, Bibi, you need to accept that there's going to be two states after this. You need to accept that the Palestinian Authority is coming in. Bibi, you're wasting the opportunity to have a deal with Saudi Arabia and normalization. On all of those fronts, Bibi wins. Bibi wins. He's not put under domestic pressure. On this, he would be under serious pressure if, and this is the crucial second piece, and this is why the administration could, if they pursued this, I think they'd have their best shot at getting to a different place. If, at the same time, they were willing to use the most crucial piece of leverage that they have, which is, of course, the provision of arms, ordinances, the weaponry, without which this couldn't continue. Let me quote one thing here. Uh-huh. The lead correspondent in the Sheldon Adelstein founded Israel Hayom newspaper.
We should say Sheldon Adelstein, far right, no longer alive.
No longer
American,
alive.
Israel supporter, big contributor to Trump and other Republicans who once seriously advocated dropping a nuclear bomb in the Iranian desert to, quote, show them we mean business. During hostilities, just to say, just as a reminder. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so the quote from this, from their lead correspondent on all of this, Yoav Limor, without Biden's support, Israel would long ago have been forced to stop the fighting in Gaza due to a shortage of weapons. Uh-huh. We now know from the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times that they have done 100 small transfers in order to avoid accountability and scrutiny by Congress. Mm-hmm. If you're not willing to put that on the table, as the United States government, Don't tell me that you don't want to see another 30,000 dead. Don't tell the supporters and the voters in Michigan or anywhere else in the country that you want to see an end to this, because you're not putting on the table the thing that could stop this. And the Israeli military would, under those circumstances, if they do both of those things, I think Bibi has an almost impossible choice to make. And like I said, Bibi may say no on day one, but if they're willing to sustain this standoff, then I think Bibi has to find a way out of this. It doesn't necessarily involve regime change. And as far as I'm concerned, that's secondary. End the killing and get the humanitarian assistance into Gaza. That's the key thing.
Okay. So first of all, figure out a deal that would work for the Palestinians in terms of ending hostilities enduringly. Actually embrace it and communicate to Israel in some credible way, which might mean saying it publicly. You have to say, we will end the weapons flow publicly. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I think they could be clear on what they're not sending. I mean, they should never have sent these 2,000-pound bombs to be used in the way they were. But part of that, they have to be very clear. And Israel simply won't be able to continue. Now, Bibi will then have to navigate. I don't think he's going to change his coalition. I think he will find a way of navigating this and moving into a different phase. By the way, you have to send strong messages on the north as well. Vis-a-vis Hezbollah and Lebanon, because this would be a dangerous moment also in terms of Netanyahu perhaps seeking to continue the war there.
Okay. So that's a very valuable thing to hear from you. I haven't heard it put quite like that by anyone. So this is the, we're approaching the end of the public part of the podcast. Thanks to everybody who stuck with us. If you want to hear the rest of this conversation, I want to elaborate a little on that, on the scenario you've sketched out, get into the question of whether ultimately there is, you know, some hope can come out of a deeply traumatic event like October 7th, which is an argument some have made. Maybe revisit the Camp David thing, as we said, we might. But if you want to hear the rest of the conversation, all you have to do is become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter. Go to Non-Zero at Substack or click a link in your Substack, your podcast app show notes. It's also a way of just supporting the kinds of conversations we have here. But in any event, thanks for sticking with us this long. And now we will head into overtime.